The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Wednesday, middle of the week, and we are going to do something very exciting tonight, really provocative. William Tompkins is back tonight. He, of course, is the man who started out as a very young American patriot, joined the Navy, and is obviously gifted to the extent that they pulled him way up to the top in terms of including him in very secretive affairs, very advanced technological affairs over time. He went on to work after the Navy with one of the highest rated and most brilliant defense contractors, Thompson Ramo Wooldridge. And there's a lot to talk about. We've had William Tompkins on the program several times before. We've talked about the space fleet we have. We've talked about where we have gone in our solar system and perhaps elsewhere. I don't have the answers. All I have are questions, and I listen to what Bill says. Major George Filer is standing by tonight. Are you there, George?
I'm here.
Where are you?
All the way from St. Augustine, Florida.
That's America's oldest.
Looking at a beautiful moon tonight.
That's America's oldest city, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Does it make you feel younger?
I don't know about that.
Well, you're in the oldest city. You ought to feel pretty good. And right. Frank Chile has made this program possible once again, a colleague of George's and mine and a friend of yours. And are you there, Frank?
I'm here. Good evening, Jeff.
Good evening. Tell us a little bit about Bill Tompkins for our first-timers, and then we'll get to Bill in just a couple minutes. What are we going to hear tonight? Tell us about the first book of apparently a series of books that his near-photographic memory of his remarkable life has made possible.
Well, his first book, which is available to the public and is creating quite a stir, it's called Selected by Extraterrestrials, and it discusses how Bill was tapped on the shoulder.
Talk a little louder, would you, Frank, please? Just jump right in that phone.
Sure. It looks like Bill was tapped on the shoulder at a young age by the military to come in and use his photographic memory to work on projects that they thought that he would be capable of as a draftsman. However, that went well beyond that and opened the door to him being involved in some secret projects and working with individuals that he believed were not from here because they were helping him in his work. And he was at a cutting edge of a lot of things that we've only dreamt of, and yet so many of the things that are coming forward now and are being revealed in his book seem to be correlated by the likes of Corey Good and by Gary McKinnon And he's providing us with much more levels of detail than we ever thought we'd ever have access to.
Right.
And I've had several nice discussions with him over the last couple of weeks, and he is just so forthcoming, and his integrity is he's of such high integrity, and his story just needs to be told. And, Jeff, I really congratulate you for bringing him forward again to share more of his amazing life. He's a remarkable individual on all levels.
He is indeed that. George Filer, what are your thoughts on Bill Tompkins at this point?
Well, he has a lot of interesting information that we're correlating, and it's tied together with, just like you mentioned, that McKinnon in England, who looked into the deepest secrets of the U.S. and came out with this information about having a space program that's not part of the normal space program that we think about, but a secret one that's very exciting. And Bill is able to correlate this information with other information that we're getting. That we try to make sure that all of this is being brought to the public. And interestingly enough, some Air Force generals and Navy generals are encouraging us to bring this information forward to the public.
Okay, run that by me in slow motion. That's really important. Certain Air Force generals and others are encouraging whom to bring the information forward?
Well, to Bill, to bring his information forward. Admirals as well as generals are encouraging us to bring this information forward to the public.
Okay, well, we're going to do that. Now, let's say hello to Mr. Tompkins. Hello, Bill. Welcome back. Thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great, and it's a real apology for me to be with you professional people.
Oh, give it a break. Come on. You're an amazing man, and if for our skeptics out there, and we have skeptics, if even half of what you say is true, it is the most astounding story that I've ever heard. So bravo to you on all counts for being recognized, for being talented, for using your talent. And Bill Tompkins had a patriotic passion for this country that few have. And that's one of the reasons that his brilliance and his genius was put to such viable work by the powers that be. It's one of those fluky kind of things. It would be a great major motion picture. Maybe it will be. Who knows? Do you remember, Bill, I think you were first on this program with your story, or nearly first. And since then, I think you've been on other programs, and certainly my colleague Jay Widener has had interviews with you, or certainly one long one, and others. Have you had a lot of exposure?
It's probably sort of unusual, because when the book hit the public, frankly, we weren't sure whether people would buy into what was going to be said. And now MUFON, for instance, that organization that investigates UFOs, I've done three different programs with them alone, and it seems like whoever calls for that meeting collects people that don't even belong in the organization, because it's jammed. And somebody is really supporting the book, and I hope it's you, fellas.
Well, it's all looking good, and the first book is out. How many would you like to do again, Bill, in the series?
We're pushing for four of them, because we really can't get a lot of the information into just one or two books.
I agree. So much I've heard already. I don't know how you could get it into one book or two. No way. All right. Where we were last when you were on this program, you were getting near to going to work for Thompson Ramo Wilders, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
So let's kind of rewind and start right there, if you want. When you joined them, how you joined them, and what they were doing.
Okay. I'm going to altered it slightly and just mentioned in between having left Douglas being fired after 12 and a half years, and then the situation where I went to work for North American Rocketdyne. And my secretary at Douglas called me after I had been fired and told me to contact one of the top people in NASA because they had a program set up for me. And so I called Dr. Debus, who was
Dr. Debus, for our listeners, Wernher von Braun's, you say assistant, it may well have been his superior back in Germany, we don't know, a paperclip scientist, a brilliant man. Dr. Debus ran NASA in its inception years and was just an incredible asset. The Germans took us into space, folks. They took us everywhere. It was all about German brilliance, not Nazi brilliance, German scientific brilliance. These men were under threat of death if they didn't produce and put out, and I think the vast majority of us would probably do the same thing they did. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you. That's definitely the way it happened. Well, I called Dr. Debus, and he said he had a corporate engineering position for me to go to work for North American company, which had Rocketdyne as a propulsion group, and then the space shuttle as another group. And so I called them, and they set up the program for me. And essentially, I spent another 4 years doing almost the same thing that I had been doing at Douglas. So it was very interesting later when I got another call, which said that there was some special work that they would like to have me to assist in over at TRW in Redondo Beach.
Right.
And I reported to the people there, and I was asked to put together a quick proposal and then implement a what you would call a station control area, which TRW, Thomson Reimer Wilgage, has this vast futuristic company 12 blocks from the ocean over in Redondo Beach.
Yeah, you know, my dad, as I think I mentioned to you, my father was a director of public relations for Douglas, and would go to the Cape all the time for launches. He knew many of the people you knew, and he would talk to me about Thomson Reimer Wilgage, TRW. And he knew so much, and I wish he could have shared it with me, but I was a little young, and he just did let on that there were some pretty amazing things going on.
Amazing is
the understatement. Yeah.
The understatement. The people that actually organized TRW is Thomson Reimer Wilgage, and they were the people that were sort of doing the pushing in the secret think tank of Douglas for many military programs, missiles and developments and space stations, all kinds of stuff that was being worked on. And so they gathered some money and put this organization together and built this futuristic campus. It's actually, you have to go there to get the feel of you know you're in space when you're at that campus.
What an amazing statement. Wow, how interesting.
But, and the feel for just being there and contributing is throughout the entire facility. It's a totally different atmosphere. Of course, all of you know that later on, Northrop Grumman bought TRW.
And it changed.
And then later on, because of the kilometer-long spacecraft carriers that we designed at Douglas. I continued that same program at TRW as one of my hobbies there.
Okay, and hobbies. Interesting. Yeah. What if that was a hobby, what was your legitimate full-time job description?
I truthfully can't say it. I was sort of a mothballed assistant to the vice president.
Okay.
But essentially, TRW has hundreds or had hundreds of separate small laboratories. And all these were secret to one another. They didn't communicate with other organizations.
Compartmentalized. Got it.
And unbelievably, so this facility essentially was given money by whom, I guess we're going to have to keep sort of off of that, to literally study
it wasn't me, Bill.
Everything.
It wasn't you, so it obviously came from, it had to be black ops money. That's okay.
You're right. But this facility had the money to study everything. There was no subject that was prohibited. And so they weren't just looking at space science or astronomy or even vehicles or astronauts. They were looking at everything. Many sub-labs were actually studying the same subject, up to as many as three or four labs studying the same subject, totally independent. Now, for whatever reason, they took this guy, Bill Tompkins, and they gave him the secretary in that office, which was for the glass windows and floor to ceiling and the carpeting and the futuristic furniture. I mean, it's unbelievable. Anyway, what I was supposed to do is go to these different labs and hear what their programs were. And let the people that were doing that study on that particular area tell me what they thought they should be doing. And I was sort of a consultant to that group.
Can you give me an idea of one or two of these independent labs? And you say there were dozens and dozens of them. What are some of the eclectic things that they were working on?
Well, there were the tunnel people, and essentially, as many of you know, the Earth is filled with massive caverns all over the planet.
Yeah, and tunnels connecting them, right.
And then they have this tunnel system that connects them. So in that particular program, it was an Air Force study, which was then implemented by TRW. And so, yes, we talked to Air Force people, not just the people that were doing the study at TRW. And we find that the Air Force had built these block-long, bigger machines for whatever you want to call them.
Tunnel boring machines. Yeah.
And so they would be a block long. They would have a crew of 30 to 40. And they would drill through rock at a programmed rate and make new tunnels. And then they would put railroad tracks on them. And they built these fairly high-speed vehicles that would run from the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., to the Air Force facility out on the desert, and then up to the launching areas in California for the missile launch.
In other words, you're saying they would go to places like China Lake, out there in the Mojave, and then on to Vandenberg as well, correct?
Yes.
All right. And now, let me say one thing about those tunnel boring machines. There aren't many pictures of them, for obvious reasons. There is one picture of one from the 1970s. It's huge. And it's painted white, as I remember the picture. And on the side of it, is a U.S. Air Force star and a bar logo, the likes of which you used to see on Air Force planes and still do, I guess. And I said, what the hell is an Air Force logo doing on a tunnel boring machine? But you just answered the question.
Yes, that's correct. And I have to bring this part in. People who I had in my group, because I only had 11 people in what I was supposed to be doing, investigating these other programs. One of the ladies that was working with the system was brought into the program from another study of similar type machines, boring machines. And so she was demanding to know from one of the Air Force generals how they were going to get their supersonic aircraft to fly from the Pentagon to the Pacific through these tunnels. And that became a big joke over and over and over all over the program.
Huh.
But the point was that drilling other tunnels, we ran into massive caverns. Some of these caverns were already occupied. So we have to back off and close and then take a different direction.
Oh, wait. Now, this is fascinating for our listeners. Some of these tunnel boring machines that run into these enormous caverns, and you heard Bill say they were already occupied. And occupied by whom? They weren't us. And so out of politeness and decorum, at the very least, the tunnel boring machines would obviously have to reverse direction and go around the cavern so as not to bother the occupants. Get the picture? Very interesting.
Yes. And so in other areas of boring, we ran into their tunnels. Well, now, who is there? Okay. Well, it turns out that several different extraterrestrial organizations have been using these caverns for thousands of years on the planet. And when you penetrate into their area, we found that we did get warnings to stop before we actually broke through, and sometimes we broke through. So their sensing system knew before we even started drilling that particular tunnel.
Wow.
What we were going to do, and they let us drill the tunnel till it was just ready to break through, and then they hit us again. And so what we found in the tunnels, and when we exposed into the caverns, that there were 3 and 4 different types of extraterrestrials there. And in some cases, there were American scientists and engineers
right.
working with them. And in some cases, we were violently driven out. Other cases, we were allowed to come in.
Wow, very interesting. And, okay, hold on, Bill. We have to pause for just a few minutes, so get a drink of water. We'll come right back and continue with Mr. William Tompkins. Mr. William Tompkins. Bill is telling us just some of the things that went on when he was with TRW. Let me get a quick word, Bill, from George Filer on this story. George, so far, what do you think?
Well, I don't happen to notice or know about the tunnels, but I do know that when I was on active duty in the Air Force, I was called into the general's office, and I was given, you might say, like secret orders. And the order said that if it was a, you know, emergency, which I assumed had to do with, you know, the Soviet Union, but in any case, there was a, I would be part of a particular group that would go to an underground base in West Virginia and set up a, you might say, a separate government in case our government was wiped out, you know, in Washington, D.C. In other words, I do know that there was underground facilities, and I had orders to go there. One of the interesting things is that I mentioned this to Colonel Don Ware, and he said he also had orders. But the interesting thing is that both Don Ware and myself were aware of extraterrestrials, and it was surprising that we would be picked out to be part of this new government, apparently because we also had this information about extraterrestrials. In other words, in a sense, I'm supporting what he's, what Bill's saying.
Got it. Okay. Frank Tilly, how about you?
Well, what Bill was sharing is some of the information that Bill Hamilton had shared with me regarding the knowledge that he had derived regarding his two-star general that was telling him about tunnel boring equipment and underground caverns that were honeycombed throughout the United States, and that there were some extraterrestrials living there. And according to Bill, there may be upwards of, what, 100 different races that are interacting down here, Bill?
That's correct. We have a real problem because I know it's hard to accept, but these different types of extraterrestrials, entities that are here, all have the capability to play with our brains and prevent us from seeing them.
I'm sure.
And I know you, this is hard for people to accept, but this is a fact. And so these people can come here, walk all over our planet, do whatever they want, and telepathically get us through mind control to do what they want us to do, their agendas. And this is an area that we really need to work on.
Okay. All right. Carry on. We're with the tunnel.
Okay.
The tunnel department at TRW. That's one.
All right. Now, just let me finish that tunnel group. In continually digging other tunnels with the Air Force equipment, boring it, they ran into other extraterrestrial tunnels. And these were completely different in that they were diameter-wise five times the width, the diameter. And they were almost no turning in them at all. No sharp turns of any kind, like you're going to see pictures of tunnels that we get involved in.
Right.
And so their equipment, they operate high-speed train systems all over your planet. And when you say high-speed, it's nearly subsonic. And this is ridiculous because the planet is round and these facilities are fantastically built. When they drive their machines into the ground, they have a system which allows everything to be brought back, converted into other materials, and line their tunnels with glass-like lining. Perfect cylinders. And so they convert the granite, the ground, into different materials, and as the machine is grinding, goes through, everything is changed into a finished tunnel. And in some cases, they were operating adjacent equipment behind it that put the rail system in almost as fast as the digger was constructed.
Right.
It's what, amazing.
What are the trains, first of all, what does the digging machine use for fuel? Is that a low-level nuclear-powered device?
It's not nuclear. It's anti-gravitational, which you say you don't need that for this, but it is a system that they use on some of their extraterrestrial for propulsion.
Oh, interesting. Wow. All right. Very good. Okay. Now, who gets to use these tunnels? Who rides them? Do the ETs ride them with us, or is it pretty much something for humans to use to zip around unseen and unbeknownst beneath us?
This is sort of got a stop sign to them. The extraterrestrials who have humans as their slave labor in their large caverns, they will have sometimes those humans come with them on different programs that are being developed in a different part of the planet. Mm-hmm. But other than that, this is a hands-off story. We're not allowed to use them at all.
Really? Oh. All right. So we don't use them. We build them and we don't use them?
No, we build our own.
Okay.
A separate set of tunnels,
yeah,
which are much larger diameter. Use high-speed rail-type systems, connecting every area on your planet. And we are not allowed to use those systems. But the main thing is how the system operates under construction. It's uncanny, the speed with which they can build new tunnels.
How many miles a day?
They were going as much as 30 miles a day. Some of them would go as many as 100 miles a day.
Okay. Now, the masses of rock that these machines go through, it's my understanding that the rock is broken down and atomically reduced in size. There, it's compacted, turned into a quasi-molten state, and then injected into the walls, as it were, of the tunnel, creating this glass-like,
yes,
smoothness. So they can move,
yes,
quickly because they're actually taking the rock and reducing the volume of it by dozens of percentage points. It becomes much less than it was, and it's reformed and put around the edges of the tunnel, around the tunnel walls. Very interesting, fascinating stuff. Okay, that's one department. Let's go back to TRW. Give me an idea of another,
okay,
department.
All right, just one thing before that.
Yeah.
Those tunnels are lit. They light up the tunnel. And you don't have a separate lighting system. The light is continuous in those tunnels, and they're actually light. It's just as fast as they're constructed.
It must be something to do with an atomic, a nuclear, a subatomic reaction of some kind that creates light.
Yes.
Something from the rock,
okay,
something from the material.
Yes.
Wow, okay. All right.
Okay, for a minute, I'd like to talk a little bit about the history lab. And it's not just one lab at TRW. There's probably 30 of them. But, again, they are funded to study all aspects of the history of the planet. And so what this gets into is the level of incorrect information that the universities, the colleges, the schools, and even the medical schools are using because extraterrestrials have created our history, and it's totally different than what our books say it is. And so we have a situation where the people that are doing the studies there at TRW in the history labs They simply are trying to establish what history really was and using timelines to accomplish this in reverse. And what they have found is, yes, there were other civilizations on the planet thousands of years ago. And they also found that there had been other floods besides Noah's flood. And there had been other earthquakes. And the studying of the history essentially came up with a total rewrite of virtually everything related to what we have been taught. And essentially, the studies, even though they're continuing over at Northrop, the study ended up saying that our history is a total lie, virtually everything. And so now we're finding out there's other ways to accomplish things, but essentially we have been fed lies the extraterrestrials. And so our situation then is that we, even in engineering, are using standards that are childish for everything. And so again, we are then now using a higher percent of our brain there, where the real numbers have been something like 2.2% is all we are really using. Whereas extraterrestrials, who have roughly the same size, are using the whole thing. And so this then touches with the numbers of times per month that the extraterrestrials dropped the five gases on the industrial areas of the planet. And so here we've got a history program going, and then we find that, and I have the photographs there of the five reptilian tankers dropping the five gases on Orange and San Diego County at 300 feet.
Now, hold on. The ETs using five tankers to drop gas on Orange County. Give me more information, please. What do these tankers look like? Whose are they? And you mentioned 300 feet. That's awfully low.
This is part of the insanity that we're dealing with.
And whose insanity is it, Bill?
The insanity is really ourselves, because Admiral Hugh Webster used to say, we're every man, woman, and child in the country should be working on this. And our insanity is that there's a total different life out there that a lot of other people are doing. We are living on a laboratory. We're inside the laboratory for all of these other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Now these...
It feels like we're inside a lavatory, not a laboratory. But that's another story.
We're in a lab. But these tankers, there's several sizes of them. Some of them are only about 150 feet long. They are very strange shape for a supersonic vehicle. And, of course, they come from a mothership, and so they just come down like a landing craft that the Marines would use.
Mm-hmm.
And so they operate at a low altitude, not because they are afraid they're going to be seen, but because they want the gases to be distributed close to the people. And so they'll fly through canyons. And I'll have to get a copy of those photographs to you folks, because if you haven't seen them, it's right. hard to even describe. The top surface has five glass-like roofs on the top of the sort of a streamlined, semi-bullet-shaped vehicle.
Okay. No wings, right?
No wings.
Okay.
The sides of it are perforated, and the roof then is perforated. And the photos that we have show five separate colors of gases coming out. And so these vehicles then come out of the mothership, they come down, and they throw the gases around specific areas on the planet that have to be stopped, technically stopped. This is what this is for.
What do you mean technically, yes. Bill, excuse me, what do you mean technically stopped, and how do these gases stop it?
What we're saying is that they're observing us talking today on the radio, okay?
Yeah.
They can listen to everything that we're saying.
That's why I have my blinds closed. I don't want to see them looking
okay,
at me.
It didn't do any good. Wait a minute. Anyway, so these fellas have standard gases that they drop, and a lot of people have seen them when they look at crop circles.
Let me ask one thing. Some of the crop circle videotapes or digital recordings do not show an aircraft. They show the trails, and then if you look carefully, out in front of the trails is a dot.
Nothing.
There's a little dot sometimes. It's obviously a UFO. It's not an aircraft. It's something else. So,
yeah,
all right, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to make that point.
Okay, and you're correct, and absolutely some of them are our own Air Force for other reasons. But yes, others are extraterrestrial.
Okay,
so this photograph sequence is about 8 years old. The photograph was taken in Carlsbad, California, on the border of Oceanside. And four couples had a party Friday night. And Saturday morning, they went out to a cul-de-sac street that looked over the side from at a little valley where a group of new condos were being built. So the four couples went to look over the side of this cul-de-sac and show them the new condos. So nobody saw any UFOs. And when they took the pictures of the party last night, and the one picture of the new condos had it developed, whoops, here's these five UFOs at 300 feet. And you can see the hills, you can see the buildings, you can see all of it. And you're going to know this is not 10,000 feet. And these five, essentially, my pickup on it was because a friend of mine took a picture. And when I took it over to Grumman, which they have a facility here in San Diego, and they did a lot of study on it, on the photograph, it was established definitely that these were tankers, and they were dropping these five gases. Well, when the gas comes out, it dissipates, and that's what they want it to do. They don't want to leave any cloud or anything visible, because the squadron leader, the extraterrestrial squadron leader of this particular gas drop, turned the stealths on that prevents us from seeing them. He forgot to turn on the stealth that would prevent cameras from photographing them. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the reason why you don't see UFOs. They're here every single day. but they have their stealth turned on.
Sure, so they're cloaked, right. Yeah, understood. Okay. Now, these tankers, they come down from motherships. What are they, a couple hundred feet long, pretty good size?
Some of them are up to 700 feet.
All right,
they're quite big. Large.
These motherships, Bill, are in orbit above the planet's surface in near space. They must be, as some people have said, miles across. They must be huge.
Yes, they are. Some of them are 20 miles.
I'm just
miles.
Making that point for our audience here. These are enormous things.
Now, wait a minute here, because this, again, is against the law.
What law? Look, these people aren't answerable to any laws.
And the whole thing is against the law. And, right. And we to this point, don't have the ability to stop these guys from doing it. And so the frequency, that's what I wanted to get you to hear. The frequency of the drops in technical areas or areas on the planet that are technically advancing in medicine or space or communication, whatever. That's the ones that they want to make sure that they are not going to make it.
They're trying to retarding our, in many cases, black ops programs of advanced technology to keep us restrained? Is that the idea? They don't want us to make this kind of progress?
Exactly. And the reason I'm using that as sort of an example here, all over TRW, is that it's difficult to accept that there should be more good guys out there helping us and not allowing supposedly insects and
right.
Dracos and these other people to accomplish their missions. But having to realize the history part of
right.
the studies at TRW, this goes back so far
uh-huh.
and through so many different civilizations on this planet,
right.
which got into the NOAA's problem.
Wow. So, Bill, hold on, please. We do have to pause on that note. And this has been a phenomenal hour to consider. We'll come back and do another one. So stay right there.